I guess even physicians get sick.
No.
He is under the weather. And so he asked me to fill in for him. So let's start with prayer. We ask Gary Lane. Let's bow our heads.
Dear Lord, we ask you to be with us here this afternoon. So we think about a controversial and difficult subject. Please be with our speaker and be with each of us as we listen and talk the points made and guide our discussion as we listen.
Amen. Thank you. We've had many months of delay and a lot of legal work, but we finally have the Michiana Adventist Forum incorporated as a Michigan nonprofit corporation. In addition to that, we've been granted tax-exempt status by the U.S. Internal Revenue Service and classified as a public charity. As if that isn't enough, we also have a bank account now. So we can receive and disperse funds, and we hope this will all be in aid of helping with expenses. This is largely expenses of bringing speakers from afar and paying for their travel expenses. So if you'd like to make a contribution, we're happy to receive it. We've put a couple of plastic containers there at the back on the table. You want to even make a donation this afternoon, that's okay. Our upcoming forums, November 14, in just a few weeks, Richard Osborne will present a topic on academic freedom and accreditation on faith-based campuses. He is the Associate Director of the Western Association of Schools and Colleges. He has been a president of Adventist College and an administrator in the Adventist Church dealing with educational matters. After the first of the year, January 23, 2010, as you see up here, we have another topic, the health of Americans. Can Adventists take the lead? And Rebecca Wang Chang Scriven will be their speaker at that time. She's the medical director for clinical quality at Kettering Memorial Medical Center. She is also clinical professor of internal medicine at Wright State University School of Medicine. So we look forward to that on January 23. Our program today is entitled Gay, The Uncomfortable Truth, and Nancy Carbonell, Associate Professor of Counseling here at Andrews, will present our topic. After her presentation, we'll have a question and answer period. Okay, Nancy.
It's all working. That's good. Sometimes it's technology. Thank you for inviting me to come and speak on this. I have to admit that when I accepted it back in August, I didn't know what was going to happen 2 weeks ago. And I wasn't even here for the meetings. Do we need to turn it down a little bit?
No, it's good. Fine.
I wasn't here for the meetings 2 weeks ago, so I want to disclose that. I had to go to another workshop in California, so it was a good trade-off, I guess. But today we're going to talk about something, a topic that can often make people very uncomfortable. And part of it is, I think we don't talk about it enough. And part of that contributes to the so many unknowns that we have on this topic. So I'm going to start off, and I want you to be very honest. I'm going to say some words. And then I want you to tell me what you're thinking when I say those words. Okay? Gay. What are some of the words that come to mind?
Happy.
Excuse me?
Happy.
Happy. What else? Good.
Rainbow.
Rainbow.
Cowboy.
Cowboy. Anything else?
Homosexual.
Homosexual. And if I say the word homosexual, what comes to mind?
Two men.
Two men. What else?
Two women.
Two women. Anything else?
AIDS.
AIDS.
Harvey Milk.
Harvey Milk.
Bigotry.
Bigotry. Anything else?
Dear friend.
A dear friend. Wow, you can see it scans the spectrum. It evokes all kinds of emotions. And I have to admit, I have gone down every one of those. And part of what has made this particular topic an important one for me is because I'm a psychologist. And I work with gays and lesbians. And I started with one belief system, which was the way I was taught, what I learned. And it kept clashing with another big value that I had, which was education, and continuing to grow and continuing to learn, and not being afraid of some of the truths I was learning. So I'm going to take you on sort of a journey that I've been on. And it's not my particular journey alone. It's actually the journey of many health professionals in the country and many scientists as well. So the premise, the guiding movement, the guiding philosophy of today's talk is to examine everything carefully, and then hold fast to that which is good. Once upon a time, Christians and scientists and evolutionists all agreed on the same thing when it came to gays or homosexuality. They were in accord, but for different reasons. You had the Christians that said, we're against homosexuality because it's an abomination. It's clear in the Bible that it's wrong, it's sinful, and therefore these people are sick, they're sinful, and they need to change. The Christian scientists agreed with that. But then you had the evolutionists and the Christian evolutionists, there are some, who said, no. The reason we're against it is because it goes against the natural order of evolution. Those traits which continue to keep a species going are the traits that continue to be passed on from person to person through natural selection. Anything that smells of interrupting that process is not part of the nature of an individual. And so they started thinking, if it's not part of the nature of man, it must be something in the family system that's creating this kind of havoc in the lives of these young people. And the theory that was developed goes something like this. The son, and in this particular case it's a gay male, is wanting affections from their dad. But dad is too removed for whatever reason to return those affections to him. And on the other hand, he's got a very controlling mother who is almost suffocating and continually taking over this kid's life. Because he lacks attention and affection, he gravitates more towards his mom. But at the same time, as he's getting older, he resents her. And so there's, on one hand, a hatred that develops between him and women. And there is a need that he has to connect in a loving, affectionate way with another male, and there you get the gay homosexual. So you see, both camps said homosexuality is an illness, it's unnatural, it's an aberration, and it needs treatment for cure. And then came Evelyn Hooker. In 1953, she was a psychologist at UCLA, and she was approached by one of her students who was gay. And he was outwardly gay. And he had a group of friends that were outwardly gay. And he invited her to some of their meetings. And she would go, and she would sit there, and she'd think, man, they look normal to me. They don't look sick. They actually look rather established. Some of them had good self-esteem. And it was kind of a clash. It was that uncomfortable moment of truth where you go, what I've been taught and what I'm seeing are two different things, and you try to find a way to make sense out of it. And this young man said to her, well, why don't you study us? We'd love to be part of a study, because the stigma that's out there on us needs to be worked on. So she conducted a study on the adjustment of male overt homosexuality. And actually, it was interesting. She got a grant from the government for that study. But even though they gave it to her, they didn't put down what it was about, because they were afraid that she wouldn't get the money if they really... It wasn't from her end. It was from some governmental guy. And because the stigma of even talking about homosexuality was huge. Well, what did she find? What she ended up doing, by the way, she took a group of homosexuals and the same number in a group of heterosexuals, and they were identified comparable by intelligence level, age, and educational level. And she gave them projective tests. One of them was the Rorschach, if you're familiar with the inkblot test. That's what she gave. And then she took the results of the test, and she gave it to a panel of three professionals who were very well trained in this area to interpret the exams. And she said, interpret these for me. They interpreted them, and then she said, hey, guess what? Half of them were homosexuals. Can you tell me which ones they were? And they went back and they said, no, we can't. We don't know which ones were the gays and which ones were the heterosexuals. Now, to us, that kind of sounds like, well, duh. Because many of us do know gays that are very well functioning, possibly. But back then, this was like, whoa. This was a moment. Almost like Copernicus realizing that the Earth isn't the center of the world, of the universe. It was that big. And people started going, wow, so you mean, do we have this paradigm incorrect? We need to go back and we need to study more about what's going on. So research started in a whole new direction. Now they wanted to answer questions like, well, how do we get our sexual orientation? Nobody had ever really thought about that. I mean, do we know when we started being heterosexual? I don't think so, at least I don't. I just know I liked Harry in the first grade. And he had big ears, and I found the best Valentine's gift for him. It was a card with a monkey on it with big ears. And it said something about, let's stop monkeying around and be my Valentine. It was perfect. I enjoyed being with him. He let me win in tetherball. And I would share hammering time, because our teacher would have this big block of wood and she'd have us hammer nails into it. And we loved that. And I would give up some of my time so he could hammer longer. And I knew that I just loved being with him. That was my sexual orientation coming out. I don't know where it came from. I didn't really decide on it. It happened. And that began a whole series of clinicians and people coming together and saying, you know, those are my perceptions as well. Those are the stories I'm hearing. I'm hearing that they're not, it's not a choice. And I'm hearing that people are finding themselves involved sometimes in a lot of turmoil, and they're not sure how to get out of it. By 1973, the American Psychiatric Association removed from their DSM, which is the diagnostic manual for all mental illness, they removed that homosexuality was a mental disorder. It's no longer on the list. There were other studies to come along and kind of suggest something else might be going on. Now that we knew that sexual orientation was out there and we weren't really sure what it was, we find that geneticists, biologists, behaviorists, and all kinds of people, are all scientists, are getting involved now. They're getting excited about this topic. And they want to start learning things like, where is it coming from? Or how come some are happy with it and others aren't? What's happening here? And so there have been some twin studies out there. I'm mentioning one here. And they found that when they took identical twins, 52% of the, if one gay identical twin was homosexual, it was 52% of a chance that the other one would be too. And then they later found out that if one woman was gay, her twin sister, her identical twin sister, had about a 48% chance of being gay. Now, some people say, well, shouldn't it be 100%? I mean, they're identical twins. But actually, those in biology and in the sciences know that anything above 25%, 30% is really indicative. There's other things going on that we don't know what they are. But even, let's take, for example, diabetes. If one identical twin is diabetic, the percentage of the odds that the other one will also be diabetic is 30%. It's even less. There's also been some hypothalamus studies where they have found that heterosexual men and homosexual men differ in the size of their hypothalamus. Of course, they're checking into this once the person has died. So there's not a lot to know just how that happens. But it's something that they're suspecting controls that section of the brain which controls sexual behavior. There have also been studies as to what might be happening in the womb of the mother. We do know that all babies are born female. And at about the sixth week, there are hormones that kick in, testosterone kicks in. And if it's a male fetus, it's programmed to be male, that testosterone level will aid the young fetus to develop into male, with male genitalia, etc. And if the testosterone levels don't attack at that level, they remain a female. And so there we get males and females. Could there be something happening at that stage where it doesn't quite, the percentages of testosterone are off? And so some scientists in Stanford started checking into that. Now, obviously, they can't perform these experiments on real-life babies. But they have done that with rodents, with mice. And they have been able to get in there and alter the testosterone levels of these mice. And voila, that's exactly what they found. They found that male mice who were given this hormone would actually act as females, and vice versa. So there seems to be some indication that it might be at that level as well. And then there are two really recent, probably within the last year, studies that I just think are so fascinating. The one is that identical twins aren't as identical as we thought they were. there's actually a lot of mutations that occur at the genetic level that we are now able to appreciate that we didn't know before. Could that be why some are gay and others aren't? And what are the genetics that contribute to that? We still don't know. But we don't only know that for homosexuals. We don't know it for heterosexuals either. And we don't know it for bisexuals. And then really recently, they came out that the body odors are linked to sexual attractions and sexual orientation. We've always heard of the scent of a woman and known that men were attracted to women by their scent. Now we have evidence to show that gay men prefer the odors of other gay men and heterosexual women, and that the odors of gay men are the least preferred by heterosexual males and women and lesbians. Now, how did they go about doing the study? I can only imagine. Just the thought of participating in a study like that kind of gives me the creepies. But this is what they did. They had these people for 2 weeks only take a bath and shower with a certain product that had no perfumes in it. It had no kinds of scents. And they were to shower and bathe regularly with those products. And at the end of 2 weeks, they had all the participants wipe their underarms with some kind of a gauze or cloth or cotton or something. And then they were put in vials and noted. And then they called in a bunch of people and they said, smell these. Which ones do you prefer? Which ones do you not prefer? You can kind of see how that goes with the imagination. And then this is what they found. Wow, you mean gay men are attracted to the odors of other gay men without even knowing? Very interesting. So what is sexual orientation and where do we get it? Do we know enough? We don't really know enough, I have to say. We don't know. We just know that it's there. And a lot of times, a lot of scientists would say it's probably a combination of nature and nurture. We do have Kinsey's study in the 40s that kind of said, hey, guess what? Heterosexual sex isn't the only thing out there. And he found in his study that 50% of all heterosexual men had actually engaged in homosexual behavior. And he was able to come up with a continuum so that at one extreme we have exclusively heterosexual, about in the middle we have bisexual, and on the other end we have homosexual. And then there were some variations in between. Now, of course, Kinsey's only taking a look at sexual behavior. And we all know how sexual behavior can be rated. I mean, all we have to do is follow the life of some heterosexuals, and we'll find all kinds of things as well. So what he found is you're also finding it in the other areas of sexual orientation. And it's been pretty much noted that if you're a 1, a 2, or a 3, you're pretty much heterosexual. If you're a 5, 6, or 7, you have a homosexual orientation. And if you're a 4, it doesn't mean that you need to have sex with both males and females to be sexually happy or have a fulfillment. It just means that you can actually go in either direction and be okay with it. They have found recently that for bisexuals, it's more that they can almost attach to either male or female if they needed to, which is interesting. Sexual orientation refers to individual patterns of sexual, romantic, and affectional arousal. And the desire for other persons is based on that person's gender or sexual characteristics. It's tied to physiological drives and biological systems that go beyond what is conscious. It's just a response. And it involves profound emotional feelings such as I'm falling in love or I have a crush on or some kind of emotional attachment. Sexual orientation involves more than just sexual behavior. And I think sometimes we get caught in that. And we see that it's just behavior. It's just part of one's sexual orientation. It includes bonds that are non-sexual in affection. You know, when you put your arm around your husband or your wife or your girlfriend or boyfriend, sometimes it's just to pull them in and say, I love you. It isn't sexual in that, now let's go to the bed, let's go for sexual intercourse. It's more a sign of affection and bonding. And so it is with others, with other orientations. Homosexuality, they found, is common in all countries, in all ethnicities, in all socioeconomic stratas, and it's enduring. It's estimated that about 5 to 10% are gay. Now, on to the next story. This really shook up the religious world. The religious communities were very, very uncertain as to what to do with this knowledge. And if you take a look at it, you'll find that four paradigms emerged, trying to make sense of this uncomfortable truth. Each group developed a paradigm that they could live with. The first paradigm was one of open defiance, and they categorized homosexuality as, no matter what everybody else says, it is a mental illness, it is a sin, it is defying what God wants, it's an abomination, the laws of God say this, and it's immoral. That behavior is paramount to, is comparable to adultery or prostitution. So what is the solution if you have this paradigm? They either repent, they're judged, but they do have the ability to receive God's grace, to be forgiven, and to turn away from their sinful ways. Some Christians looked at that and said, I don't know, man, I think there's something else going on there. And we feel that maybe they can't do much about it. You know, after hearing their stories, it's like these people, they're fighting. If you listen to the gay stories, their story goes like this. They knew they were different. And how did they know? Well, when everybody else is goo-goo-eyeing somebody of the opposite sex, they're going, ew, that does nothing for me. And then around the seventh grade or so, they start to say, whoa, this is because puberty has hit and hormones come in. They start to say, whoa, not only does that not do anything for me, but I'm actually attracted to, or I could have a crush on so-and-so who's of the same gender. And then sometime around that time, they hear what gay is and what homosexuality is, because probably they never knew until then. And the story goes that I've heard over and over and over is they then go into a deep depression many times, especially if they belong to a spiritual belief that is against that. And they feel like they're abominations. They feel sinful. And they try then to change. And they pray. And they go to bed crying. And they pray, Lord, wake me up in the morning so I'm different. And they wake up the next morning and they're still gay. And that is a struggle that they have all of their life. And some of the churches were recognizing that and said, okay, we don't go with paradigm one. We'll go with paradigm two, and that is that it's an illness. For some reason, it's an illness, which it's an addiction. They're getting into behaviors that create addictions, and then they don't know how to get out of the behaviors. The only way to break addiction is like alcoholism or pornography. You stop doing it. Complete abstinence. And the onus to change, again, falls on the homosexual. And they must choose to be celibate or possibly conversion therapy or reparative therapy is an option, which many, as we'll see how it developed, became offered. The third paradigm goes even further. And there were some churches that said, wait a minute, that still is putting the blame on the person. And if sexual orientation is something that we don't choose, and not only that, but many people know they're homosexual while they're still virgins. They haven't even involved themselves in any kind of sexual activity. Which was interesting. One student in my class said, well, you know that you're homosexual because you have sex with them. But how many of you knew you were heterosexual? You found out you were heterosexual. No, don't raise your hands. How many of you found out, I wonder, but I don't really want to know, knew you were heterosexual because of your first sexual experience? Oftentimes, you know much earlier than that. And so some of these churches said, no, this person is an innocent victim of whatever is happening to him, whether it's biological, combination of biology and one's environment. It's a tragedy in nature. It's because God, not everything God wanted happened in this earth. We have other tragedies that show us that on this earth. We have people that are wanting to have children and they can't. That wasn't in God's original plans. They're infertile. And we have kids that are born blind or people who can't walk. Some are born without legs, and we don't say to them, well, I guess God said you shouldn't have legs, so I guess you're just going to sit there and not move. We as a society have said, we've got to make special rules for them. And so we develop wheelchairs, and we develop special parkings, and we develop adoption agencies. And we say these people are victims of something God never wanted or hoped for. But it is a reality. So let's find a way that they can live their lives in the fullest of all possible ways and help them go beyond the limits of their handicap. These churches and these Christians then support committing loving relationships in the spirit of Genesis, that no man should live alone. And they say, okay, we'll make special rules. And we will take a look at ways to keep you within the committed relationship by allowing you to have these relationships as long as they're loving and committed in the spirit of God. But there's a fourth paradigm. Some churches went even further. And they said, let's celebrate the diversity. God is a diverse God. Homosexuality is just another one of those varieties we find in nature. Let's delight in differences. God does. Take a look at all the fish, all the trees, all our fingerprints, our expressions of love. Could this be just another variety, like left-handedness? Now, you know, left-handedness was one of those varieties that were not well accepted when I was a kid. I can remember Susan. She was a left-handed one. And the teacher was constantly telling her to write with her other hand. Somewhere that they learned that it didn't really make sense to continue pushing kids in that direction. One gay person said to me, I wonder how all those heterosexuals would feel if we suddenly said they had to try to be homosexual. Now let's just try. It's just sort of like we were telling left-handers to be right-handed, how would the heterosexual world be able to do that? So anyway, the solution to those were to celebrate homosexuality and see it as a gift of God and encourage loving, committed relationships among them. Someone said to me, you can't win a World Series unless you have some left-handed people on the team. I'm not that into baseball, but those of you who are probably understand that better than me. So they say left-handed people are gifts. Well, so are homosexuals. Now, these four paradigms were very uncomfortable. Each paradigm had its group of proponents and opponents. And what we find is, especially those who were in the paradigm one and two, they then said, you know, we've got to get organized, you guys, because there's a lot out there that is being tooted as wrong, and we need to go out there and change that. And so they developed in 1976 Exodus International. And it was to fight against the claims that one cannot change one's sexual orientation. Yes, you can. Come on down. Let's do it. And so they developed an organization that was interdenominational. It was founded by Michael Boosey, Gary Cooper, etc. And the message of freedom from homosexuality was broadcasted to all the churches, all the congregations. They taught that reparative therapy, and they continue to teach, that reparative therapy can address this unwanted sexual attraction, same-sex sexual attraction that homosexuals have. And it continues to be supported by organizations such as Focus on the Family and other fundamentalist Christian churches. Techniques that they use in reparative therapy are varied, and in the early 70s, they were very aversive. They would take homosexuals and connect them to electrical shocks, but they would only be shocked once they saw a picture of a homosexual or a male. It wouldn't even have to be homosexual, just a picture of a male. And if they noticed any kind of attraction, boom, they'd shock them. Or they would give them medication to vomit, and then they would show all these pictures of males or females, depending what you were struggling with, hoping to pair, right, the stimuli, which was the pictures, with something in a very adverse, and hoping to kill the desire to be gay. But they also had other kinds of techniques. One of them was abstinence, practicing abstinence, lessening homosexual temptations. And oftentimes that was by don't masturbate even, because they found that homosexuals, people tend to, if they masturbate, they tend to think of that which is arousing to them. You see where I'm going? Whether you're heterosexual or homosexual. So we just have them not engage in any kind of masturbation to invite them to have those kinds of temptations. They would strengthen their sense of masculinity. They teach them how to walk, like John Wayne. They would teach them to talk differently instead of going up and saying, hi. Hi, man. They would teach them to engage in sports. They would have them dress up, you know, more manly. And then for the females, they would do the same. They would say, you need to wear dresses. You need to be more flirty. Let's practice flirting. They were led through devotions and prayer and Bible study, especially focusing on the texts that showed that God could not approve of that, and to remind them why they were coming in for reparative therapy. And they would try to change distorted interactions that would occur. Like if one said, I'm just not close to men, or I'm just not close to women in a non-sexual way, they have tried to set up situations where they can enjoy the same gender but in a non-sexual way, or enjoy the opposite gender in a more flirtatious, sexual way. In 1991, NARTH also was formed, and that's the National Association for Research and Therapy for Homosexuality. And if you go into the literature, you'll find that most of the proponents for conversion therapy are either members of NARTH or Exodus International. And this organization of researchers in mental health all believe that reparative and conversion therapy is the way to go, and it's the way to set gays free. Interestingly enough, in 1998, after quite a few studies, the American Psychiatric Association states the following. The potential risks of reparative therapy are great, including depression, anxiety, and self-destructive behavior. Since therapist alignment with societal prejudice against homosexuality may reinforce self-hatred already experienced by the patient. Many patients who have undergone reparative therapy relate that they were inaccurately told that homosexuals are lonely, unhappy individuals who never achieve acceptance or satisfaction. The possibility that the person might achieve happiness in satisfying interpersonal relationships as a gay man or lesbian is not presented, nor are alternative approaches to dealing with the effects of societal stigmatization discussed. Wow, that really got the controversy going. And the Psychiatric Association came out with that at around the same time that the American Psychological Association did too. And there was reasons for that to happen. There are high numbers of gays that try to commit suicide way above the norm. Even if you take into consideration age, it's in the 30 percentile during their teenage years. There was a lot of who were depressed and unable to function. I've seen them in my office. And so as a mental health organization, they had to come out and say, "This, we need to start taking a look at this and dealing with this issue differently." Spitzer, who happened to be one of the main psychiatrists that was on the board of the American Psychiatric Association back in 1973, when they removed it as a mental disorder, in the early 2000s, he said, "I wonder if this reparative therapy is working." Nobody had really stopped to take a look. So he thought, let me go find some people that have participated in that. You know, we hear a bunch of bad things, but there might be some good stuff that's happened. And so he gets on, and he contacts NARTH, and he contacts Exodus International, and he contacts other therapists who are practicing conversion therapy. And he, after much searching, comes up with 200 people who had all claimed to be cured at the time when they ended the therapy. They claimed to be cured of their gayness. The study consisted of a 45-minute call to these individuals who had these claims. And if they found that the participant was a married person, they also sent a questionnaire, a survey, to their wife. And he found that, yes, indeed, some did report that they were able to change their sexual orientation after therapy. In fact, it was 17% of the 202 that felt that as males they were able to change to become heterosexual. and 54% of the females were able to change. The anti-gay organizations loved it because this finally gave them some proof that they were trying to hang on to and to prove their point. His study claimed that all gay people could go from gay to straight and through prayer or through therapy. The only thing was that what was being reported out there didn't reflect accurately what Dr. Spitzer was really wanting to say. And so in 2001, in May, the 23rd of 2001, he published in the Wall Street Journal the following: "I did not conclude that all gays should try to change, or even that they would be better off if they did. However, to my horror, some of the media reported the study as an attempt to show that homosexuality is a choice, and that substantial change is possible for any homosexual who decides to make the effort." Well, because his study was so crucial in their theory, and because he happened to be one of the psychiatrists on the board, it was very tempting and very hard for the anti-gay organizations to stop using his results. And 5 years later, he once again had to send a personal communication to James Dobson, Focus on the Family, asking him to stop exaggerating the study on their own group's website. And he said, "I understand that you are publicizing my statement that sexual orientation can be changed. I ask that you do not do this unless you also add my belief that such change is probably extremely rare." In 2002, with all this controversy going on, Scheidlow and Schroeder did another study. And they wanted to avoid some of the pitfalls of Spitzer's study. One of the pitfalls of Spitzer's study was that the individuals who participated in his study, they said that they were homosexuals and had been cured, but there had been no measurement as to, were they really homosexuals? Were they maybe bisexuals? Or were they, where were they along the continuum of Kinsey's scale? So they put into effect that they gave the Kinsey scale to everybody that said that they had been cured. And to be a participant in their study, they had to rate along the lines of the 5, 6, or 7, so that they were primarily homosexual in their tendency. And after 5 years of interviewing, they came up with 202 persons who had received at least 6 sessions, that was another qualification, that they received at least 6 sessions of any form of conversion therapy with a licensed psychologist, psychiatrist, or counselor. And they also had to have expressed desire to change their sexual orientation. One interesting factor that they found was a lot of these people were religious and were motivated because of their religious faiths. But there were other individuals who wanted to change because they were married. They tried to be heterosexual and had gotten married and wanted to preserve their marriage for their kids' sake or for whoever's sake. But they couldn't feel that natural desire towards their spouse that they were wishing to have. So they did find some individuals like that. What they found was, out of the 202, 133 said they were Christian or claimed to be religious in some sort, which is 66%. They had an average number of 118 sessions, 26 months worth of therapy. Quite a few years ago, I worked at a mental health, community mental health center, and we were asked to monitor how many sessions we averaged with our clients. And I had about 150 clients at that time. And I sat down and I added up all the numbers. And an average number of sessions that people had coming to see me were between 6 and 20, depending on the issues. 118 sessions are a lot of sessions. They're a lot of sessions. And 26 months means they were seriously going in there and trying to work on stuff. They also found that by the time the study interviewed them, the researchers interviewed them, an average of 12 years had lapsed between the time that they had ended their therapy until they were interviewed. And this is significant because what they have found in other studies was that many people who claimed to be changed couldn't hang on to that claim 2, 3, 4 years later. 12 years gave them a lot of, if you're changed, you're changed. I've been heterosexual all my life. Nobody's changing me. So if the change works, it's going to be more consistent and conclusive. And this is what they found. The pre-entry, again, like I said, they all had to show they were a 5, 6, 7 on Kinsey's stage. And they all reported sort of a honeymoon phase. It was, wow, I'm so hopeful. I know this is going to work. They're offering me exactly what I want. I want to get rid of this. This is exciting. And then 176 said 12 years later that they were totally disillusioned with what happened to them. And 26 said it was successful for us. When they took a look at the numbers even further, they found that out of the disillusioned, some were dissatisfied asexual people now, and some were conversion, started to feel like their conversion started to have all kinds of cracks in it. So that when they went even further and asked them questions like, what did you gain, or what do you think was harmful to you? There were 155 out of the 202 who reported being injured by this type of intervention. And 21 reported being resilient. On the successful side, they found that there were three main categories of being successful. The first category is, I'm successful, but I'm still struggling with it. And that was 12 out of 202. And that's with the continual use of HBM, which is homosexual behavior modification, all these techniques that they've been taught to continue practicing every day to keep themselves straight. The second category was successful and not struggling at all, and there were six of those individuals. Interestingly enough, six of them, out of the six, a lot of them said they were actually celibate. And then there were eight out of the 202 who said that no, they had actually made a shift from being gay to being heterosexual. Let's take a look further at some of the results. When they asked them what were some of the harmful effects of the therapy, many claimed to have tried to commit suicide afterwards. The sense of hopelessness that they fell into, that abysmal sense of, oh no, it's still here, and that sense of helplessness overtook many, and they wanted to end their lives. Some said the loneliness and the social isolation returned, but even greater. Now they had to decide, do I get out of the closet again, or do I just stay in the closet? Coming out of the closet when you're going for conversion therapy is actually wonderful because suddenly the people that they have missed contact with, their churches, their family members who are adamant in them changing, now are there to help them. Good, you're going to change. We're going to support you. We're going to pray for you. We're going to work with you. When you say, as many of these did, it's not working, you guys, they would hear, well, you're not praying hard enough. You're not faithful enough to God. You're not reading the Bible enough. And at some point, they then started to, you can imagine, hate themselves even further. Addictive behavior went up. some acting out behavior. There were many who said, or some who said, I just started having sex with everybody I could. After all, I'm a miserable abomination. I might as well act like one. Sort of sounds like self-fulfilling prophecy. And they started just having anonymous sex. In fact, some of them said, I kind of wished I would have gotten AIDS and just died. They weren't courageous enough to take their own lives. Many got into binge drinking and use of drugs. Part of the therapy was to tell them, you're a child abuser if you don't change. Afterwards, they started, some of them started questioning, am I a child abuser? Could I be a child abuser? They felt that they were lost in their lives, that they had lost a lot of their life trying to change. And some said, I'm angry about that. I'm tired of trying to change something I can't change. And it had a negative impact on their religiosity. Some completely lost faith in God. What kind of a God is this, I've heard? He's doing this trick to me? Forget it. Others felt betrayed by their religious leaders. Their leaders were telling them that they could change. And here they're proving that it didn't help. It's interesting because I went back and read, I didn't realize the history within our church, but our church was one of the churches that did try to do reparative therapy. And in fact, the GC contributed to help the families who had gay members in their families to go and see a gentleman by the name of Colin Cook. I kind of remembered hearing about him in the early 80s when I was here on campus. In one way, I'm moved by that the church didn't just stop and say, deal with it, you guys. I think the church had a real genuine desire to help and to subsidize those sessions. I was very moved by that. But of course, if you're misguided as to the effects of reparative therapy, you could be doing something that you think is very good and is very damaging. And what happened was eventually, if some of you might know the story, Colin Cook really had a hard time staying converted as a heterosexual. And with time, he got back into his homosexual behavior and apparently even ended up, from what I heard or read, abusing some of the same patients that were coming to see him for therapy, which was an atrocity. And it was an atrocity for the church. It was an atrocity for the parents who had invested money and hopes. And it was a greater atrocity to these young people who felt their only option was to change. They found that the clinicians were also the focus of their anger because these clinicians had introduced punitive and shaming concepts of God, and they were now angry about it. And in the end, many of them were excommunicated from the church or removed from offices once they shared that they could no longer live a heterosexual life. So let's take a look at that percentage. There were 24 who actually said they were converted. Let's take a look at them. The 4% who actually said that they had shifted from being gay to being heterosexual, they then later found that 7 of the 8 provided ex-gay counseling. They were actually in some way engaged in work to help others change. And 4 out of the 7 were actually paid positions as ex-gay conversion counselors. They don't know if that influenced the self-report, but they're just reporting what was up. 9% of the individuals in the 202 found that the homosexual behavioral modification techniques tended to help them with celibacy or in the struggle to manage same-sex desire. And here is a definition of what HBM was. It was cognitive reframing. For those of you who know what that is, it's finding a way to take out the thoughts that come natural to you or probably even interfere with your life, those thoughts that you don't want to act on, replacing them with other thoughts. like, for example, imagining you're going to get AIDS, so you want to stay away. Some of these behaviors that were taught to them was abstaining from masturbation, using opposite sex surrogates. That blew my mind. They were teaching these people, get your sexual frustrations out, but do it with the opposite sex. Go see a prostitute. Go get a surrogate, a friend that will work with you on that. Whatever you do, don't go home. They were asked to play team sports, go to the gym, praying, reading the Bible, and just get immersed in their work. It was noted that although sexual orientation did not change for most of these individuals, a rare few apparently became skilled enough to ignore or even tolerate their attractions, or limiting the impact of their attractions on sexual behavior. Now, they did find that the participants also had some benefits from going to conversion therapy. The first one, and one of the biggest, was they could finally talk about it. Many of these individuals had lived in secret for years, and now they could talk about it. And they didn't have to worry about disappointing mom or dad or pastor or teacher or neighbor or pathfinder leader. They could just talk and tell their struggles and their pains and their uncertainties and their confusions. They were able to have a moment of increased hope that maybe this was going to work. Maybe this would get me what I want eventually. I want to have a good relationship with my parents. I want to have a good relationship with my church. Maybe this was going to help. That from there went senses of improved self-esteem because they felt that they had a rally of friends to support them, and they liked it as long as it lasted. Some gays and lesbians said, wow, for me it was absolutely fabulous because I did everything I could and I realized I really am gay. I realized I really can't do anything about it. And that was a relief to them. Some said it had helped improve their relationship with their parents because their parents saw them really fight to change. And when even if they didn't succeed in the change, the parents said, we love you, son, and we accept you as you were, which they were not able to do before. And they felt accepted by the group as long as they were trying to change. And I'm putting this in here because I do know that a lot of, and I don't know who you are, but and they might not even be here, but if you are ever to counsel somebody to go into conversion therapy, I think it's important that you know the truth about it. Interestingly enough, 2 years ago, three of the ex-leaders of Exodus International, two of which were the co-founders, explained the deceptive nature of their organization. Not that they were trying to deceive people into believing they could change. I really believe they honestly got into it hoping to offer gays another option. But once there, and once realizing that they too were struggling with their own sexual orientation, they continued to push the message that change is possible. And they made a public apology to all the gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered people who they felt they had helped to misguide, claiming that sexual orientation was changeable and necessary for one to get God's love or to receive God's love. I didn't want to put the YouTube on here, but for any of you who'd like to go take a look at their public apology, you can go to YouTube and look under Former Ex-Gay Leaders Apologize. Is it any wonder then that the scientific and mental health professional world are against, clearly against, reparative or conversion therapy? That's the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Association of School Administrators, the American Counseling Association, the American Federation of Teachers, the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Physician Assistants, the National Education Association, the National Association of School Psychologists, the National Association of Social Workers, the National Education Association, all of these associations, which represent thousands and thousands of people who work with the gays on a daily basis in their homes, in their offices, in their schools, in their communities, realize that reparative therapy is not only ineffective, but harming. The American Academy of Pediatrics came out in 2007 and said, sexual orientation probably is not determined by any one factor, but a combination of genetic, hormonal, and environmental influences. The American Counseling Association makes it clear that they do not offer or condone any training to educate and prepare a counselor to practice conversion therapy. What's more, they strongly suggest counselors do not refer clients to a conversion therapist or to proceed cautiously once they know that the counselor, fully informs clients of the unproven nature of the treatment and the potential risks it and takes steps to minimize the harm to their clients. In 2007, a couple years ago, the American Psychological Association put together a task force to take a look at what are the treatments out there and what should be our therapeutic response to sexual orientation. You can go online and get a copy of it. It's a long document, but it was thoughtfully done, and their results are same-sex attractions, behavior, and orientations are normal and positive variants of human sexuality. 2, gays can live satisfying lives as well as form stable, committed relationships and families that are equivalent to heterosexual relationships in essential respects. 3, an enduring change to an individual's sexual orientation as a result of sexual orientation change efforts was unlikely, and some participants were harmed by the interventions. 4, no empirical studies or peer-reviewed research support theories attributing same-sex sexual orientation to family dysfunction or trauma. 5, psychotherapy, self-help groups, or welcoming communities, ethnic communities, social groups, religious denominations, provide social support that can mitigate distress caused by isolation, rejection, and lack of role models. One of the things that we have found is there are quite a few churches that do support, they're called gay-friendly churches. And I just happened to get on to gaychurch.org, and they have actually a listing of gay-supportive churches throughout the whole world. I just happened to click on Michigan. I have no idea how many there are in Michigan. There's 168 churches in Michigan. And if some of you have, sometimes we have Christian gays who don't feel safe to come to our church. They might be able to find another place to go. There's one more story, and this is more personal in nature. I'm going to come out of the closet. Some of you who know me already know, and some of you are going to find out for the first time. But my oldest son, David, is gay. He came out to his dad and me 6 years ago. And you know what I told him? After all these years of experience, because I graduated in 89, I've worked with lots of gays, I said to him, you know, David, I'm so ready for what you're sharing with me. You know that. But please, can you just keep it quiet another 3 years? He was a sophomore here at Andrews. Why would I tell him that? Why? Think with me.
Save embarrassment to your professional career.
Save embarrassment to me? Possibly, but it wasn't. Really, it wasn't about me at that point in time. To protect him. To protect him from who? Well, the president of Andrews, the teachers at Andrews, the people in our church at Andrews. Who was I protecting him from? I don't think I even really said, I know I'm protecting him from this or that. It was just this feeling of I didn't want him to get hurt. I was wanting to be his cushion. And you know, part of it is because we don't talk about it. I don't even know what you guys think. I have no idea what our community thinks. Probably if I was here 2 weeks ago, I might have heard part of what our community thinks. But I don't really know. It's not something we talk about. In all the years I've been here, this is the first meeting that I've really come to that has talked about. But I know they did have some a couple weeks ago. I just wasn't here. And I'm glad to see that the communication is starting to open because it's not about my son. My son's going to do fine. In fact, he said to me, Mom, don't worry about me. I'm going to be okay. Don't worry about me. I've already lived 10 years in the closet. I can't go back in. And while he was here at Andrews, he was openly gay. His friends knew it. His teachers knew it. His roommates knew it. And you know what? They didn't abuse him or bully him. They loved him. And so his story taught me another thing. And this is what he said to me. He said, you know, Mom, if I go into the closet, then everybody's going to keep thinking that homosexuals are these perverts that are promiscuous out there. I am a virgin, and I'm hanging on and waiting for that monogamous relationship that might come along my way. That's his decision. That's his choice. And he said, you know, Mom, if God hasn't changed me till now, and I tell you, Mom, I prayed. It's because God can love me as how I am. And I really was taken aback by that. And at some point, soon after that, I started wondering how much was I contributing by staying silent. You know, there's a lot going on in our nation now. Politically, in our churches. I think a lot of people are trying to get a handle on this. And I think it's all motivated by true love and a desire to make the right decisions. I don't know which paradigm you represent here, but I do know that all of us, from what I could hear, all of us want to love our gays and lesbians back to our church. What that will look like, I don't know. I think we need to have some serious discussion on that. What will that look like? And isn't it hard if we're on different paradigms? It might be. But we've had other challenges before. You only have to take a look at some of the challenges we have gone through and continue to go through on racial issues or women's issues. This is just another one that is challenging to us as a church. David Myers, a professor of psychology right here in Holland, Michigan, and who is well known for his advocacy in trying to help families. He's given extensive workshops on pornography, which he feels is one of the most destructive things that we have in our church and is running rampant, even among our clergymen. And those who deal with teen issues, teen sex and everything, he says, isn't it therefore wiser to enjoy God's acceptance just as I am? Can we not accept our own and other sexual orientation without excusing promiscuity, exploitation, or self-destructive behavior? Everywhere our culture seems preoccupied with the homosexual threat to family values. I'm reminded of C.S. Lewis's tongue-in-cheek advice from senior devil Screwtape to his apprentice devil by telling him, corrupt by diverting their attention. Yes, yes, that's what we'll do. The game is to have them all running around with fire extinguishers whenever there's a flood. Some of what I might have presented today, what might have been uncomfortable to you, and I understand that. It's the clashing of two values that we as Seventh-day Adventists have traditionally held. On the one hand, we have the value of maintaining our church positions on various issues. And on the other hand, there's the value of continuing to find and to seek what is true, and not to be mere reflectors of man's minds or messages. May we continue this journey of searching and finding out what is the truth. Because these gay people, it's just not my son. He's going to do okay. He's doing very well. But there are others out there who are not. And they're left to deal with this all by themselves. And I finish with examine everything carefully and hold fast to that which is good. Thank you.
Okay, time for a few questions. I don't know that we can answer everybody's questions, but let's try a few. And remember our forum rules. We don't assume agreement, but we do expect civility. So, questions?
I don't think the mic's on. If it is, it's not turned up much.
It's okay. I'm loud. I talk. I just stand up. Well, my question is, for young kids who have been raised in a home with a parent, with a man, with a mother, father. And then, let's say the father's very abusive, and then the mother turns gay, and the kids now were raised with this idea of man and woman are to be together, and then the mother becomes a lesbian. What should you do for the children? Because in their minds, they've been taught this their whole lives that this is what's right. And now the parent that they look to is contradicting what they've been taught. How do you help children who are dealing with
my experience with kids is that they can be informed and deal with the information. What happens is, if you take a look at even our campus, and I saw it very much when my son came out, his friends didn't have a problem with it. They were more exposed to homosexuality in many areas. In my generation, I graduated from high school really not knowing what a homosexual was. It was never discussed, never heard of it. And I remember being in a biology class even asking, what is it? Kids can handle the issue. The problem in your situation is it's very compounded. You've got spousal abuse, and then you've got a family that's breaking up, which is a trauma in itself, and then you've got so many compounding elements there. I'd be happy to talk to you more about it maybe later. But it is a very serious situation. The issue, though, isn't only mom's sexual orientation. There's some other bigger issues that are happening that are making it all crazy.
Oh, you just want me to...
Talk loud.
Yeah, you got the mic, right?
Yeah, it's not working.
This is more of a comment than a question. It's simply that in view of what many hold to be the plain statements of Scripture relative to homosexuality and what seems to be information as to what the truth really is, the church, not only in the area of homosexuality, but in other areas as well, is going to have to go through somewhat of a paradigm shift, it seems to me, in terms of how they view the Bible, how they contextualize it in terms of its historical reference, is going to be rather difficult. And the process of which is going to be maybe titled The Church Comes of Age, The Adventist Church Comes of Age. I don't know if you want to comment on that. It's just kind of a response that I have to you.
I think our church has moved. From the feedback I got from what happened 2 weeks ago, the church moved from faiths from paradigm one to paradigm two. It used to be paradigm one. Now it's paradigm two. Let's find ways to be sober. Let's go for reparative therapy. And that's where the church is. So I'm very hopeful in that respect.
Dr. Kermanel, speaking earlier about the root causes, you had you'd mentioned 10 to 15% roughly were estimated to be homosexual.
5 to 10.
5 to 10, maybe. Has there been any speculation as to whether or not or why not we don't witness that in other species?
Actually, they do. There's like 150 other species where it's witnessed. Penguins and porpoises being two of them. There's 150 different species where it is common day occurrence.
I am not sure of the motivation of his presentation, so I don't want to judge, but it is very clear that in the scriptures that homosexuality is sinful, it's unnatural, it is immoral, an abomination. In light of that, I'm wondering, when God gave Eve to Adam, why didn't he give him a man instead of a woman? And my second point is, in regards to conversion therapy, last 2 weeks, two gentlemen were here. One is now a pastor. He practices 16 years. He's now converted. He got married. He has a wife and children. And he's a pastor. He said he'd never go back into that lifestyle. And he's absolutely sure that he's changed. That's his testimony. And the second one practiced for 37 years. Bakley, I think. And he's just got rebaptized in the church, and he pledged that he'd never go back into that lifestyle. So I'm wondering if you're saying that the person cannot change from homosexual to heterosexual. I believe that in most cases, change is painful. If you're a smoker, you want to give up smoking, it's painful. So in many aspects of life, change is painful. So would you be able to relate to the question I asked? Why didn't God give Adam a man for
the biblical evidence that you cite with such certainty is problematic. I mean, the same Bible that you cite was cited by slave owners in antebellum South that the Bible supports slavery. Yeah, that's what they said. That's the authority that they cited for their position of slave owning. So you have to be careful when you cite the scriptures with such absolute certainty. I'll let her answer the change.
But you know, I think Matthew, I think you're on an honest journey. I see you on this journey. And you can only move where you feel you can move honestly. And I appreciate your journey. I was there. And I'm not even saying that your journey is wrong. It's just your paradigm doesn't fit my paradigm. And so what ends up happening, this I didn't talk about, but in psychology we've noted, and you can see it, just watch the political scene, we all tend to gravitate towards the sources, the interpretations, the books, the speakers that support our positions. And that's what makes it so uncomfortable to change. It's more than just uncomfortable because we're not doing God's will. It's much bigger than that. And I think if we leave it at that, we're doing a disservice to the whole topic.
Let me
You don't have to stand if you can talk loud.
Okay, I'll try. Yeah. I guess I'm not entirely convinced that the scientific community or the science on this is as monolithic as you painted. The 5 to 10% on the Kinsey report has been significantly challenged, and I think other numbers are more in the 1 to 2% range that seem more realistic, both from study and from our personal experiences. But I was wondering if you have seen the Jones and Yarhouse report and study of the Exodus International therapies and looked at the figures there that don't show perhaps absolute change, but show a high percentage of significant change along the scale, and what you think of their work.
I don't know their work totally, but I do know that Dr. Yarhouse was here, so I did take a look. His study is not a peer review study, number one, and so that there were some things about his sampling which would not hold up under rigorous scrutiny. That's all I want to say.
I had a question, an observation concerning how this all happened in the supposedly beginning. I think you hit on something that we need to perhaps develop more, just like a child that's born without an arm is helpless to do anything about it. And like one said to me just recently, I was born this way. In other words, I can't change. Well, if you go back and start throwing this, I was born this way, I think then you're going to be throwing it in the lap of God. God, you created me to be a sinner like this. And you tell me you can't save me. On the other side of it, if you were born this way, then with this handicap, then we've got to come to find out, how can we help this person with this handicap to be the most normal possible? And I think this is the issue the church is going to have to really take a look at, because like in our Sabbath school class, our teacher asked one day, how many here have family members that have openly said, we are gay? Every hand went up in the room, saying it's all around us. And God loves these people. He wants to save them. Now, how do we go about helping this adventure take place? It is one of the most difficult issues I think our church has had to face, perhaps ever, and especially when it gets close home to you. This, like you with your son, there's nothing more precious to any of us than our own children. When we were missionaries in South America, I used to have general conference people come by, and frequently they would have dinner at our home. And I would ask, tell me about your children. Invariably, 100%, my kids have walked away from this. And then I would ask them, please tell me, what is it that caused them to turn their back on what you've given your life to? I think it's because I've given the church too much. Invariably, they would tell me this. I went back to my office. I made a list of 1 to 10. What are the most important things in my life? And I thought my job would really rank way up there. I think it hit a 4 or a 5. Most important thing for me is that my family enters in one day into the streets of gold, and I want to be with them. That's number one. And we put ourselves in that priority list and begin to figure out what it is that's important to us. It'll help us to resolve some of these issues right now that we're having to face, like this particular issue.
You know, the reason when I was talking to Dr. Gray about this, one of the reasons I felt it was very important to talk about was I had just been approached by a teacher on this campus who had a young man in his class who was visibly trying to contain tears throughout the whole hour that the class was running. And the teacher, how wonderful, said to the kid afterwards, come to my office, let's talk. And the kid went to his office, and the teacher said, "What's going on? You're struggling with something. Tell me." And the kid said, "Oh, I can't talk about this. This is just not something I can talk about." And the teacher said, "Come on, open up. I've heard all kinds of things. You'd be surprised what I've heard." Did a masterful job in gaining the trust of this young man. And this young man finally said, in a very weak voice, because it's so hard to even come out to yourself when you're gay. And he said, "I'm gay." "You're gay? Wow. Do your friends know? Do your teacher knows? Do your parents know?" "I haven't told anybody." And he talked with the teacher, and the teacher said, "You know, you should really tell your parents. This is something you shouldn't be dealing with alone." And I think if there's some sadness in my heart, it was that my son dealt with all of this all these 10 years by himself. I'm shocked that he wasn't bedridden with depression every day, that he got good grades, that his teachers and his friends loved him, and that he was a good student. I'm surprised he had the energy to do that. We need to find ways to make it safe. It's not that we even have to convert them to one of our paradigms. The big thing is we just got to listen to them. A few years ago, I was asked to give workshops at St. Mary's College, and they wanted to establish safe zones where they could put a little tag outside of the teachers who had gone through this training, so the students would know it was a safe place to go to. And maybe we can do something like that on campus. I don't know. It just seems like we need to do something to not leave them alone.
It's been over 30 years ago that a student came to my office and had to tell me, or felt they needed to tell me, that they were coming out with me. Do you find that people who have a homosexual orientation are quite sensitive to those with whom they can take the chance of exposing their position?
Oh, yeah. They know who to trust and who not to trust. Yeah, I think that would be for any of us, no matter what our issue is. You know, we seek out the people we feel we can trust.
Has any research been done in terms of homosexual families and how the children grow up in related society?
Actually, the studies are, you know, are relatively new. Gays haven't been able to, first of all, adopt. It's very hard to adopt if you're not married. And so, you know, they would have to have adoption agencies that would allow them to adopt children to a couple who aren't even legally married. And so there have been quite a few situations, actually, where they have found that the kids do fine. And in fact, there's a couple things. Do I have time? How much time do I have?
Well,
not much. I'll just suffice it to say there are studies that show. I'm sorry?
Just shorten it.
Oh, shorten it? Done.
Say it quickly.
Yeah, they are seeing that the kids do fine. And I heard one girl say that she always hoped she could be homosexual like her moms. And she cried the day she realized she was a heterosexual. So it's not going to influence them. And some of us, I think we get caught up, or we've gotten caught up. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it because we don't want our kids to be contaminated or something. And that's not going to happen. If it's not there, it doesn't suddenly.
Okay, I just want to respond to his, I think, very fine comment. I like much of what you said, but I'm not sure this is the most important issue the church faces. I could think of racial issues, gender issues. I would suspect that even financial. I mean, I think it would be strange if we offered President Andreas and another $50 million to run Andrews. Him saying, "No, I don't need it. I'm doing fine, thank you." I don't think he would say that. I'm going to guess that he wouldn't say that. I think there are other issues that are pretty
what I meant
difficult.
By that, it's an emotional,
yeah, that's
highly
true.
Impacted issue, yes. that really digs all of us when you get down to it. Yeah. I mean, it could be a bomb exploding in a short period of time, and I think we need to work on it.
Yeah.
Well, and it has been for many churches. It has created havoc in the churches because you have a church, all are believers and want to follow the truth, and they might be in different paradigms. Then you've got, a lot of consternation.
Well, let's stop there. Thank you very much for your questions, your civility. Let's thank Professor Carpenter.